And I will not be surprised when the report comes out if they say we need another $1 billion or more to finish this.
Voters will decide on funding for the troubled Anchorage port expansion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 29th. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, Vic Fisher's new autobiography tells the story of his childhood, including escaping with his mother from Stalinist Russia.
Things got very desperate. She was being interrogated by the KGB, and they wanted her to become a spy if she were allowed to come to America, and she refused.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfort. Details at Condor.com.
Bundled into the bond proposition included on the November 6th election ballot, voters will find $50 million for the Port of Anchorage Intermodal Expansion Project. It's the largest request on the list, but voters won't have much information on the project before they make their decision. That's because a report detailing problems with the bungled upgrade to the 50-plus-year-old port won't come out until after the election. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
The municipality has had a draft of the port study since mid-October, but they don't plan on sharing it with the public until November 9th. Mayor Dan Sullivan maintains he's signed a non-disclosure agreement that does not allow him to release the report or to talk about it. During Mayor Sullivan's weekly press briefing last week, Anchorage Daily News reporter Lisa Diemer asked Mayor Sullivan to discuss the report. She pointed out that officials at the U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration did not say the study's findings on construction problems had to be withheld.
I'm wondering if you've been able to rethink that at all, or if we can maybe find out what the conclusion was of that study before the bond vote on the general election ballot that has port bonds included.
No.
The Port of Anchorage expansion project has been in the works for more than a decade. The municipality of Anchorage partnered with the U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration on the project. In 2003, construction got underway, then stalled around 2009 after serious construction problems came to light. Cost estimates skyrocketed. Upward of $300 million public dollars have been spent on the project so far. The municipality is seeking $50 million additional dollars on the November 6th ballot for the port expansion. Bob Shavelson with the watchdog group Cook Inlet Keeper and a longtime critic of the project says voters should know what the bond money would be used for before they cast their ballots.
Well, the public absolutely has a right to know how $50 million in public money is going to be spent.
Shavelson says Cook Inlet Keeper started looking into the port project in 2007 because of concerns the design could hurt Cook Inlet beluga whales and salmon populations. With fewer federal dollars flowing into the state from Congress, Shavelson worries taxpayers will bear the burden of the flawed project and questions where the funds to finish the job will come from.
The Port of Anchorage is vitally important to everyone in Alaska, and now we're in a situation where you can't build this thing half out. You've got to build the entire thing, and I will not be surprised when the report comes out if they say we need another $1 billion or more to finish this on top of the $50 million that we would get from the bond package, which I bet is just to fix the problems they've already had with the current design.
Shavelson is speculating. Staff with the mayor's office say they can't put a price tag on the project until the final reports are out in February. At the Anchorage Assembly's weekly meeting, Tuesday, October 23rd, Mayor Sullivan and the Assembly went into executive session to discuss potential litigation regarding the Port of Anchorage. Assembly Member Jennifer Johnston.
I move to go into an executive session to receive legal advice and strategies regarding potential litigation involving the Port of Anchorage.
The executive session lasted more than an hour.
Second. Any objection?
The Assembly sealed information from it for 5 years.
Seeing, hearing none, we're going to move into an executive session.
Assemblymember Dick Traney said he would have rather had it sealed for 10 years. Sullivan recently sent the Anchorage Assembly a memo asking for $2 million additional dollars to cover fees for attorneys related to port litigation. That is in addition to $500,000 already set aside to cover attorney fees. Mayor Sullivan's office was contacted repeatedly for this story, but he did not make himself available for an interview. His spokesperson, Lindsay Witt, says the municipality has a draft of the report, but Sullivan has not yet read it. The Anchorage Assembly and the city's Geotechnical Advisory Commission are scheduled to be briefed on the port study at a November 9th work session, 3 days after the election. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A new report finds that alcohol and drug abuse cost Alaska's economy $1.2 billion in 2010. That number includes direct costs, such as $218 million spent on criminal justice and protective services, and $237 million on health care costs. But the report, which was commissioned by the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, says the largest impact comes from lost productivity. Kate Burkhart, the executive director of the Advisory Board, explains.
Which includes things like premature death due to alcoholism and drug abuse, diminished productivity due to impairments. So that's things like days lost at work, excessive sick leave, the inability to hold a steady job, days lost at work because of jail or time in treatment. So those are actually costs that are most directly felt by our business community.
The report also looks at the impact that substance abuse in adults can have on their children. Burkhart says the goal of the report is to provide hard data to communities and to policymakers about the impacts of alcohol and drug abuse. The report was compiled by the McDowell Group. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making learning complex subjects relevant in Barrow.
When you talk about quadratic functions and say, remember when we studied the blanket toss, they know right away. It sticks. So that's the important part.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Candidates for three state Senate seats representing portions of the Fairbanks area are on the November 6th general election ballot. The candidates took questions from the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce-sponsored forum last week, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Alaska's oil tax was a key issue.
The oil tax debate that dominated last year's legislative session has not gone away. Efforts by the governor and many lawmakers to lower the production tax paid by North Slope oil companies ultimately failed last spring, but another push to drop the tax to spur oil production is likely this coming year. District B Republican candidate and former Fairbanks Senator Pete Kelly says Alaska is getting beat out by lower production tax states like North Dakota.
High oil prices have created a boom there. It should be creating a boom here. Problem is, their senators kicked our senators' rear ends. They made their state competitive. Our people did not. We're suffering the consequences from it as day by day, drip by drip, the amount of oil that goes through the pipeline goes down and down and down, and our futures might be going with it.
At issue is a trigger in Alaska's ACES tax plan called Progressivity, which elevates the state's tax take as the price of oil climbs. Kelly's Democratic opponent, incumbent Senator Joe Pascvan, says he supports lowering the progressivity rate somewhere north of $100 a barrel oil, but stresses we need to keep in mind other provisions in the oil tax package, like credits for new oil field development.
Our royalty is 50% or less than 50% of the royalty that you'll see in North Dakota or Texas. When you add the credits in, it has a dramatic reduction in the percentage of the government share.
Pascvan and fellow Democratic State Senate incumbent Joe Thomas credit new technology with spurring production in North Dakota and Texas. Thomas, who voted for ACES, says he supports tweaking the tax structure, but only if there's real commitment from the oil industry to produce more crude. Senator Thomas says his opinion is based on what happened prior to ACES when Alaska employed a tax structure called the economic limit factor.
We know that for 17 years the ELF was in place, and it was a very favorable tax situation, and there were billions of dollars invested, and we did not reverse the decline. We need to have a business arrangement with the industry of how we will move forward, and everyone will jump on board. That's all that people are asking for, is what will be done differently.
Thomas says there's been too much talk among legislators about the oil tax and not enough with the oil companies. Thomas's Senate seat A opponent, Republican incumbent John Coghill, says requiring a legal commitment from the oil companies to increase production in exchange for a tax break is a mistake.
The business arrangement we have with the oil companies starts with the leases, and they agree to produce. But when you start agreeing that for a tax reduction we'll do this, then you run into some constitutional questions on limiting your taxing authority. So I think what you do is you make yourself more attractive in the world, and then people come and invest.
Senator Coghill says he was wrong to support ACES and now favors a break in the progressivity tax rate at $90 a barrel oil. Another Republican running for Senate agrees with that ballpark number. Former State Labor Commissioner Click Bishop, running for Senate District C, says legislators need to settle on an oil tax break somewhere between the $500 million and $2 billion amounts talked about last session.
There's a number that we got to hit in the middle, but as big as that number is to incentivize new production is the enabling language behind it. Has to be good to stand the test of time, so we're not down here having a do-over again.
Bishop's Democratic opponent, Ann Sudkamp, was the only Senate candidate at the chamber forum to totally reject the idea of an oil industry production tax break. Sudkamp says evidence points to holding the line on taxes.
Studies have shown that ACES has not decreased oil production on the North Slope. There's more people working up on the North Slope than there ever has been. We have new exploration coming up.
Sudkamp, a political newcomer, says the extra $2 billion a year Alaska is taking in because of ACES should be used to better the state, including technology and other infrastructure upgrades, so Alaska is prepared to prosper in 50 or 100 years' time when oil is no longer a factor. Voters decide who fills state Senate seats A, B, and C in the November 6th general election. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
It's hard to get excited about school when you're reading a typical textbook written in the Midwest and you live in a place with no trees, no sidewalks, and no elevators. That's why educators on the North Slope are making a change. In the next installment of our Being Young in Rural Alaska series from the producers of Kids These Days, reporter Ann Hillman looks at how the North Slope Borough School District is helping kids connect to academics and culture all at the same time.
When Robin Stockton started teaching math in the North Slope Borough 16 years ago, she did it like everyone in the lower 48, with examples like the arc of a fall ball to teach parabolas.
They may have it down one day in a class. 3 days later, they have no idea what we've done because it just didn't make sense outside my four walls. When you can't apply it to anything or tie it to anything in your everyday life, it's not going to stick.
So she made the math lessons apply to her students' lives.
Tying quadratic functions to a whale bomb. When you talk about quadratic functions and say, remember when we studied the blanket toss, they know right away. It sticks. So that's the important part.
The problems with standard teaching examples don't start with abstract math. It starts with the books kids read in elementary school. Kids can't relate to climbing trees or feeding chickens at a big red barn. Those things don't exist in their community. They know more about riding snow machines over the tundra and butchering whales with their families. And that's the motivation behind the North Slope Borough School District's new teaching curriculum. It systematically incorporates Inupiaq culture into every subject while still meeting all of the state educational standards. School Board President Debbie Edwardson says the board and the community have been trying to incorporate Inupiaq culture for years.
What we had done before was create lots of units for use in the classroom. What we're trying to do now is completely regenerate our system from an Inupiaq base upward. We've never done that before.
The first step was to talk to all 8 of the communities in the district and find out what they wanted their kids to know and be like when they graduated from high school. They used that to develop the Inupiaq Learning Framework, which lays out the core values and ways of life that the community wants taught in their schools. Then Stockton and a team of other teachers and administrators used a proven method of curriculum development called understanding by design.
The whole UBD process is having the end student in mind and students being able to take the content they've learned and apply it to real-world tasks.
The new system meets the state standards and the community standards in an effort to get kids more motivated and involved, and district officials say it's working. Attendance rates are at record highs for the alternative school. The number of office referrals at the elementary school has been cut in half, and the dropout rate is almost halved as well. 15-year-old Donna Sabo says that when last year's end-of-the-year writing prompt focused on families, it made it easier for her to show her abilities.
It was a kind of a good change, and like we understand it a little more, and it's not like, what do you think about like the trees or like about, not politics, but somewhere around there, I don't know.
The culture-focused curriculum also gives students the chance to learn more about their identities, something that school didn't used to do. Sabo said she stopped doing cultural activities because she was too busy with academics and sports.
Now that I'm getting older, I feel like I made a bad decision and I didn't continue on with my cultural whatevers.
Now, as the district undergoes the lengthy process of cultural integration, students won't have to choose between culture and academics. Middle school principal Carla Seavey says it gives the students a forum for educating each other.
You might think they all have the same experiences in terms of hunting or, you know, subsistence lifestyle, and they don't all necessarily. So a lot of our kids can learn from their peers about their own culture.
And they can also learn about other cultures. Only 60% of the students in Barrow come from the region. Others hail from around the world, including Samoa and the Philippines. Middle school teacher Tony Basson says the framework helps the students connect to each other and see how they're similar.
I had one boy yesterday said, yeah, I'm a hunter-gatherer. We gather rice in the Philippines. So it just makes a connection, and whether or not it's not a Inupiat, but it's still that hunting and survival. You know, you see it in all cultures.
Inupiat communities aren't the only ones trying to incorporate culture into their schools. The Alaska Native Knowledge Network is amassing culturally based curriculum resources and making them available to the state's teachers. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has developed an elementary school math series based on Yupik knowledge and culture. And in Southeast Alaska, the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute recently released coursework for grades 6 to 8, focused on Alaska Native history and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Reporting from Barrow, I'm Ann Hillman.
Pictures and more stories in the series can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Come to Sitka Whale Fest on November 1st through the 4th for a weekend that combines current North Pacific scientific research with a variety of fun community events and whale-watching cruises. This year, there's a convenient Juneau-Sitka ferry schedule. Information about early registration and discounts at sitkawhalefest.org. Whale Fest is Science Made Festive and a program of the Sitka Sound Science Center. This message sponsored by the Sitka Whale Fest.
In 1924, Vic Fischer was born in Berlin, Germany, as a citizen of both the U.S. and Russia. That complicated, worldly start in life offers a small glimpse into the extraordinary childhood of one of Alaska's most loved statesmen. Fischer tells the fascinating story of his early life, which includes escaping from both Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia, in his new autobiography, To Russia with Love, An Alaskan's Journey. The book, co-written with Charles Woolforth, also explores how Fischer ended up in Alaska and became one of the youngest delegates to Alaska's Constitutional Convention. Fischer also worked as a city planner, a state senator, and a professor, among other things. His mother was Russian and his father a famous American journalist and author. Fischer spent a lot of his childhood in Russia, but in 1939, under Stalin's brutal dictatorship, his mother was working to get the family out of the country.
My mother could not get permission to leave Russia, and things got very desperate. She was being interrogated by the KGB, and they wanted her to become a spy if she were allowed to come to America, and she refused. And then my father, in desperation, asked Mrs. Roosevelt for help. He had met her in connection with his Spanish involvements. And she invited him to the White House, and they talked, and she then talked to President Roosevelt, and within 2 or 3 weeks, we were out of the country.
And where did you go initially when you first left?
We initially went to New York, and I finished high school in New York. And in the meantime, my mother moved to Pennsylvania, and that became my base of operations while I was in the U.S. Army during World War II.
What did the next 10 years, when you got to America, to New York, you were 14 years old, what did that next decade bring?
Well, the next decade got me to finish high school. I went to University of Wisconsin, enlisted in the Army during the first semester there, served 3 years in the military, was in France, Germany, and then redeployed to the Philippines and the Pacific toward the end of the war there, and then went back to Wisconsin, finished my undergraduate education, and got a graduate degree in city planning, which was my chosen field.
It sounds as if your dad was fairly absent from your early life. Why was that, and how do you think that shaped who you become?
Well, part of writing this book was really learning more about my parents and about myself and relations with my parents. And I realized the extent to which my father was absent. He did a lot of traveling. When he was home in Moscow, I remember he worked very hard. He wrote many books aside from being a journalist and a reporter. And so he was always, you might say, almost tense in his commitment to writing. And so as kids, we were to be quiet. And we lived in one room in a decrepit place. And so there were physical constraints on life. He was just not much of a father. He was just, unlike my mother, who was all heart, he was just a much more severe, highly disciplined person.
And do you think that those two kind of opposing personalities of your parents, how did they come together in Vic Fisher?
Well, my brother and I were overheard talking when we were about 3 or 4 or 5 years old. And my brother George was telling me, in response to some complaint I had, he explained to me that, well, the difference between us is that I was born by Papa and you were born by Mama. And so he had a very good analysis there, because I was much more like our mother, sort of much more relaxed, more personable. My brother was very driven, and he wanted to operate in a high level of activity and in politics and everything that he touched, whereas I was the easygoing, lovable and loving kid. So that's really, I'm sure I got it more from my mother than from my father.
Here you are in New York first, the epitome of a large city in the U.S., and going to college in Wisconsin, Madison, I assume. And then you decide to come to Alaska. How did you choose Alaska, especially for a man who wants to be a city planner in a place that is fairly devoid of cities in 1950.
Well, these were really not very connected, the planning and the desire to come to Alaska. I was going on a troop ship during World War II across the Atlantic, and there was a ship's library, and I was in contemplating what professional pursuit to follow after the war. I thought of architecture. I had started off in electrical engineering, which was dear to my young heart. And then I started thinking of architecture that would have more of a social connection, social purpose of dealing with people. And then I discovered the field of city planning, and I thought, oh, well, this is sort of my mechanical, technical aptitudes connecting with my social commitments. And so I decided on city planning. Concurrently, I was thinking about where in the States I would go, and I had enjoyed going from New York and Pennsylvania, going west, all the way west to Wisconsin. And so I started thinking, well, maybe further west. And the ship's library had a series of books on various states and territories, and I read about Oregon and Washington and Idaho and other western states. And then I discovered I can go further west to Alaska and north. And as kids, we were always thinking in terms of being pioneers in Siberia. And here was this pioneering country, Alaska. And I read a whole book on Alaska, and I thought, wow, this is what I want to do. So the two were not directly connected, but they were parallel paths, and then they came together.
Vic Fisher has a new autobiography called To Russia with Love, An Alaskan's Journey, written with Charles Woolforth. They will celebrate the book's publishing with a book launch at the Consortium Library at UAA tomorrow from 5 to 7 p.m. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Ann Hillman in Barrow, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grantmakers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge would create a second link between the Mat-Su and Anchorage for use during highway closures, emergencies, and as a potential evacuation route. For more facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.